Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Work continues on improvements at the Gateway Arch Grounds, the National Park, more formally known as the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial. We'll have an update on the project in a few moments after we discuss the man for whom the park is named, Thomas Jefferson. It was his vision that opened the West to American expansion, just one of the credits on a resume that includes president, governor, diplomat, and, of course, author of the Declaration of Independence. He was a prolific writer and a good one. Our guest on today's program has sorted through thousands of pages of Jefferson papers and documents. Eric Peterson has put together a series of 34 essays in which Jefferson wrote about happiness, forgiveness, love, patriotism, and much more. The resulting book is Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. He's an obvious admirer of our third president, and I spoke with him a few days ago and asked him what drew him to Jefferson.
Thomas Jefferson, of course, is America's great visionary. I mean, he set forth the vision of faith, dignity, and mankind's basic needs, equal rights, justice, and freedom. It is touchstone of our democracy. It's an ever-living vision, and I had the chance to read through everything that he wrote. He wrote some 20,000 letters, and as well as all the state papers and so forth. And when you have a chance to read Jefferson in his own words, you can't help but feel struck by the uplifting nature of what he was offering. He was a seer. You know, he was a dreamer of a better future for all Americans. And so I wanted to take his wisdom and make it easily accessible and available for people today.
You know, you mentioned going through all of the volumes of material, and I'm sure one of the things you were struck with, as I have been, is his abilities as a writer. He was a wonderful writer.
I think he ranks right up there with Shakespeare, quite frankly. Lincoln was, he was Lincoln's most admired, you know, American predecessor. He had a great facility with language. He read three or four languages, spoke three or four languages, and he read seven languages. And he also, interestingly, collected the languages of Indian tribes. He thought that was a subject of great interest to him. He collected 40 Indian tribal languages phonetically and saved them and studied them throughout his life. And unfortunately, that wonderful collection was lost to history when the wagon in which it's being carried spilled in a river, and he was coming back from Washington after he retired as president. So he loved languages. He loved the elegance of expression. He was very clear in his writings as well as subtle. And so when you read him, his writings are compellingly fresh. I feel that he wrote poetic prose, and he expressed a ennobling thought. And my publisher at Random House for this Light and Liberty book calls it the book that Thomas Jefferson never wrote, although every word is his, because obviously it's all his writings organized in an interesting way.
What about his background, do you think, led him to what he became? Obviously, an intellectual. I mean, you look at his resume, if you will. It's just an incredible series of things that he has done over his lifetime. His upbringing, what was it that made Thomas Jefferson Thomas Jefferson?
I think it was an inner thing. When he was talking about the, it came from wellsprings within, you know, the essential, you know, heart and soul of Thomas Jefferson as an individual, aspiring human being. he was very well educated, as you mentioned, and he had read, he was a great reader of history, but he was interested in every subject. He was influenced by the ideals of the Scottish Enlightenment. And when it came to writing the Declaration of Independence, you know, one time he said, "We had no need to hunt up ancient dusty parchments. You know, we looked within and found these principles inscribed on the tablets of our hearts." So it really came from something very deep within Jefferson, and I think within all the founders. They were real seers. They knew they had a tremendous opportunity to advance the condition of humanity that very few other eras had given anybody the opportunity, and they were determined to make something out of it and really take advantage of the opportunity that was presented to them and fix in place, you know, permanent principles that represented the ideals of our nation.
In his writings, and it's included certainly in your book, Light and Liberty, he references a number of his colleagues and compatriots, if you will, in a very general way. What did he think of them? What did he think of the Ben Franklins and the George Washingtons and the James Madisons?
Yes, it's under one of the 34 chapters called Seeing the Good in Others. And he was very keen, keenly perceptive of character traits and qualities in other people. And he has wonderful short biographical sketches of a number of his compatriots, as you mentioned, and I include some of them in the Light and Liberty book. He really thought that it was a generation. He saw their greatness. He saw their capabilities. He knew what they sacrificed. You know, when he wrote pledging, you know, our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor in the Declaration as a pledge in support of the Declaration, he wasn't kidding. Many of them had their property confiscated. Many of them were quite at risk of being hung for treason. And so they really sacrificed and risked a tremendous amount. And they were very capable. If you name them off, you've named several of them: Samuel Adams, John Adams, George Washington, even Alexander Hamilton. He has some nice things to say about as a man of, you know, rectitude in his personal dealings, even though he disagreed with Hamilton's political philosophy. So he's very capable of seeing the good in others, and he saw it and he recognized it in virtually all of his fellow founding patriots. He knew them all. He wrote the Declaration when he was 33, and he lived for another 50 years after that. So he knew the entire founding generation very well and had tremendous appreciation for their capabilities and what they contributed to our country.
Did he stand among the others as an equal, or, you know, in retrospect, looking back, was he more than equal to those of his compatriots?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Clearly, they appreciated him by elevating him to the various posts. He was, of course, the author of the Declaration when he was 33, but he was a junior member at that time, and it was said that he said very little in open meetings. He worked in conferences and through drafts to get his ideas across. As his career went on, he progressed from there to be governor of Virginia, and went on from that to be the minister to France, following Benjamin Franklin over there from 1784 to 1789, where he actually saw the opening scenes of the French Revolution. He came back. He was our nation's first Secretary of State. Then he became first vice president under John Adams, and then two terms as president, as we all know, and even founding the University of Virginia. So in each of those capacities, those were expressions of the trust that his fellow citizens and leaders at the time placed in him. He was a reluctant server. He saw an opportunity to serve. He really said he always preferred his farms and his books and his family. But the times he lived in, he said, were so momentous that he was called upon to serve. His fellow citizens recognized his capabilities, and they put him in all those key posts. And I think it's fair to say that while George Washington was the leader of the country who achieved our national independence, Thomas Jefferson was the leader who consolidated the victory of that independence over a long 25 or 30-year period, really establishing the principles of egalitarianism, which he had set forth in the Declaration of Independence.
He had an interesting relationship with John Adams.
Yes, he did. They were compatriots. Mr. Adams was primarily responsible for having Thomas Jefferson appointed as the author of the Declaration of Independence. They worked together in Europe when they were both ministers over there, Mr. Jefferson to France, Mr. Adams to England. And I came back, and, you know, the tensions between the two philosophies of government, trusting the people a lot or trusting them not so much, which was the battle between the Federalist Party and the party of Mr. Adams and as opposed to the party of Mr. Jefferson, the Democratic Republican Party. So they entered a period of tension. Mr. Jefferson defeated Mr. Adams in the presidential election of 1800. It was a period of estrangement, but they got together in the last 15 years of their lives. Their correspondence is historical and magnificent, and many of these short expressions of wisdom that I have in the Light and Liberty book of Mr. Jefferson's writings are, in fact, taken from that wonderful correspondence.
And they died on the same day.
Same day, 50 years to the day after Congress approved the Declaration. So it was July 4th, 1826.
You know, you can't have a conversation without Thomas Jefferson, particularly in today's world, without bringing up the slavery issue and the whole Sally Hemings thing. I'm sure you find that perhaps overworked, but what's your take on that? The man had slaves, and he had a relationship, apparently, with one of them.
Well, I think it's a very unfortunate attack on Mr. Jefferson's character. Having studied his life pretty carefully, I don't think that the the attacks really are warranted. So just a couple of, reasons to offer on that. And I might mention also that I have a website for this book, if I might mention.
Sure.
It's the name of the book, lightandliberty.org, light and liberty with no spaces, .org. And on that website, I've actually have a half an hour video called An Innocent Man. And it's the story of the Sally Hemings travesty. He was falsely accused of this by political character assassins of the defeated Federalist Party during his time as president. And it's been picked up in the last 20 years by what I would call academic character assassins who on the basis of essentially nothing, recycle this old political smear from his presidential era as if it were a fact. There's no evidence to indicate anything at all of an affair with Sally Hemings. He denied it in private correspondence. He did not live that kind of life. It was definitely a charge, trumped up by his defeated Federalist opponents. And in fact, there was some DNA evidence about 15 years ago that came out that showed that one of 25 Jefferson males, not Thomas Jefferson, was likely the father of one of Sally Hemings' children. And of course, not too many people know that he had a fairly wayward brother named Randolph Jefferson, who in all likelihood was the father of at least one of her children. Maybe one more point on the whole Sally Hemings nonsense. It's complete rubbish, and it's continually to be recycled by people who should know better. There was a study done about 10 years ago by 12 well-known scholars from different fields, led by Professor Robert Turner at the University of Virginia. And they published their work. It's called the Jefferson Hemings Scholars Commission Study of the Issue. It's about 500 pages long. It evaluates every single aspect of it, and they conclude virtually unanimously that the charges are almost certainly false. On the slavery side also, he definitely held slaves, as did virtually everybody back in those days. Mr. Jefferson did way more than anybody in the founding era, as far as I can tell, to ameliorate and roll back and eventually emancipate slavery and the condition of slavery. He had a couple of paragraphs that, as a public figure with full public awareness of his actions and absolute opposition to the institution of slavery, which was so, as we all know, entrenched in society at the time, basically immovable. But he tried to move it for about a 15 or 20 year period during the 1770s and 1780s. And he did a number of things. I might just tick them off. He had a couple paragraphs in the Declaration of Independence condemning the slave trade as an abomination and crime against nature. And in those two paragraphs, he said, he, the King of England, has caused men, capital M-E-N, to be captured in one continent and dragged thither to another to live miserable lives of oppression and bondage as a reason, one of the 25 reasons for independence from Great Britain. And, of course, that was the same Declaration of Independence in which he uttered the phrase, all men, lowercase M-E-N, are created equal, indicating his conviction that the African-Americans were equal in their deepest essence and in their human rights. Those two paragraphs, unfortunately, were struck from the final copy of the Declaration of Independence, which was approved by Congress. It would not have been approved had they remained in there, and the representatives from South Carolina and Georgia insisted that they be removed. He did a number of other public actions like that. He had a whole program he introduced multiple times in the Virginia legislature to actually legislate the emancipation of slaves in the year 1800. He said, after the year 1800, no one shall be in slavery, and they'll be given their freedom as they reach their 21st year. So anyone born after the year 1800 would know that they would be free, and society would provide for them, give them training how to be independent, self-providing citizens, and they would educate the mind of the white man to sort of lessen the prejudices and so forth. So he had a number of programs like this throughout a good 15 or 20 year stretch, and that while the spirit of the revolution was high, public actions, and everybody knew where he stood on it. When he came back from France in 1789 and he saw that the spirit of the revolution had dissipated and that people were back into politics as usual and so forth, he saw that there really wasn't any practical opportunity for him to do anything further about it. So he remained essentially silent on it for the rest of his career.
You know, I don't know you, but I do sense, in just listening to you, an increase in your emotional level when you talk about this part of Thomas Jefferson. I can feel it and sense it, that you want to be his defender.
Well, I appreciate your observing that. I feel have worked with his thought and his ideals so much, and I feel he's so important to our country that I feel essentially like a friend of his across the reach of time, if you will. I mean, he's not here to defend himself, and he has been pretty much used as a punching bag by a lot of academics and comedians on these two subjects, I think wholly unwarrantedly. And when it comes to the actual life that he lived with the slaves, you know, most people associate slave owning with really oppressive cruelty of whippings and things like this, that, you know, 12 years a slave and all this kind of, you know, reality of how horrible slavery was. But of course, there was a whole spectrum of treatment of slaves, and that was on the far end of the cruelest treatment. He was, by all accounts, recognized as a benign, decent master, if you will, giving his slaves opportunities to learn skills and trades so they could provide for themselves independently when their opportunity for independence came. There's a wonderful story that his daughter told when he came back from France as the minister to France in 1789. They said, "Don't make a big fuss." They had three slaves on three plantations. They all found out about it. They came to Monticello, waiting for him to come up the hill in his wagon, and he gets out of his carriage, and everybody's cheering and crying and carrying him on their shoulders. These are enslaved African Americans carrying him on their shoulder back to the house, indicating that he was basically a decent person, treating people in a caring, decent manner in the context of a horrid system.
Did you find any contradictions in the man, and given what he wrote and how he lived?
Well, you know, he was definitely not a saint. I would call him more of a seer. He was a seer. He was a dreamer of a better future for all mankind. He had a brilliant mind, of course, and he also had a vast heart, and indeed, I think he had an illumining soul, and it's his vision of light and liberty, of freedom and oneness, if you will, that has lit the way for all of America's future. And so he dedicated his life to the service of mankind. He said, "If in the course of my life it has been in any degree useful to the cause of mankind, that fact itself bears its full reward." So he felt happiness, individual happiness, the pursuit of happiness, which he's so famous for that expression in the Declaration, could largely be found in a life of service. So he dedicated his life, a life of service, to the betterment of his country and to the entire world. That's what he was all about. And to the extent that any contradictions or, you know, character flaws can be identified, they are certainly of a very minor nature. His whole life was one of trying to educate and illumine and work for the betterment of his fellow citizens.
That's Eric Peterson talking about Thomas Jefferson. We'll be back in just a moment to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back to our conversation with Eric Peterson. We're talking about Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Peterson has edited a book of several essays of Thomas Jefferson's. And as we continued our conversation, I asked him how Mr. Jefferson would fit in today's world.
I think if you encountered Thomas Jefferson today, you would find a man who would be still a Renaissance man, who would be interested in basically everything. One time he wrote, "There is not a sprig of grass that shoots uninteresting to me, nor anything that moves." Can you imagine being so enthralled and enchanted by life itself to think a thought like that, right? So he was interested in everything. He was interested in natural sciences, mathematics, physics, chemistry, philosophy, agriculture, astronomy, literature, history, everything. He read everything he could get his hands on. He had one of the most wide-ranging libraries of the time. And so he was almost more of an artist, if you will, than he was a public figure, as advanced and well-known as he was for that. So if he were to be here today, I think he would be a profoundly perceptive commentator on the status of our society. And again, from our point of progress here that we've made since 250 years ago when he lived, where are we now and how can we make progress? He always said, "I like the dreams of the future better than the history of the past." And he said, "We too shall encounter follies, but if great, they will be short. If long, They will be light, and the vigor of our people will get the better of them. This was a tremendously optimistic, positive-spirited person. And if he were here today, he would encourage us to take advantage of the freedoms that we have that the founding generation and succeeding generations fought so hard and encountered such difficulties to achieve. And we have these freedoms now. And I think he'd be saying to us, okay, what are we doing with our freedoms? Are we squandering them? Are we wasting our time? Are we trying to progress, help each other, illumine our society, have a more cultured world, have a more respect for each other, have more human fulfillment? That was his idea, the philosophy of happiness. He said, the giver of life gave it for happiness and not for wretchedness. And, of course, by happiness, he meant, you know, real, deep, abiding inner satisfaction and not mere passing personal pleasures. So in whatever status of society he would be in today, he would be advocating and championing these principles in an optimistic vision of the future for our society.
I want to pursue that point in just a moment, but I'm thinking as you talk here of what it must have been like to have been an intellectual, a writer, and a thinker, and a reader 250 years ago when the time that you had to do a lot of these things was at night in the dark, and you're doing it all by candlelight.
That's exactly right, and it was along that theme. It was really a 3-mile-an-hour world. You know, your horse or your carriage literally traveled at 3 miles an hour. So it took 30 miles a day. So it took Thomas Jefferson 3 days to get down to his second home that he built after his retirement from the presidency down near Lynchburg, Virginia. It's called Poplar Forest, also worth a trip for any visitors. Or it took him like 5 days to drive his carriage up to Washington when he was president, or 8 to go to Philadelphia, that kind of thing. So it was no electricity, no modern conveniences, no indoor plumbing toiletries. It was all pre-industrial age, pre-information age. And so it was slow moving, it was hard work, it was all manual labor. Most people at that time were engaged in agriculture. 95% of our citizens at that time, 5 million when he was president, were farmers, and they didn't have any conveniences. It was all hard work. Somehow they managed to build a great foundation for our society, and they had to do it by candlelight, as you indicated.
Right. What would his party affiliation be today?
Well, he was certainly a person who felt that you had to accept the world as you found it and work within the system. And so even though a lot of his ideas would be very different from both parties, if he chose to engage in public service from the point of view of political participation, I'm not sure he would, but because he had so many other capabilities. But if he were to engage in public life through the political process, he would choose one party. I have no idea which party it would be, because it's all throughout our history, the two parties and their predecessors have championed various things that Thomas Jefferson said. And in fact, in the Civil War, the North championed his advocacy of the Union. He at one point he said, "This American Union is the idol of my soul." Can you imagine how deep a conviction that was? So the Union people embraced that, okay? The Southerners, even some of them still today, champion states' rights and say we should be able to determine our own fate here. Local government is the best. And, of course, Mr. Jefferson was a very strong advocate of decentralized government, which the Republican Party is always talking about. He said, least power at the central government, more at the state, most at the local level, you know, the level closest to the people. He said famously that you place under every individual what his own eye and hand may personally superintend. So those are principles that you would sometimes more associate with the Republican Party. So in a sense, you know, he is and was above party. He was for fiscal conservatism. We know when he won the presidency in the year 1800, Mr. Adams had built up war fever with France over some French naval depredations. And so Mr. Adams had increased taxes, increased debt. He had passed the infamous Sedition Act of 1798, which made it a crime even to utter an opinion critical of the great Adams administration. So Mr. Jefferson comes in his famous inaugural address, he said, "We are all Federalists. We're all Republicans." In other words, we're all united in principles higher than party. So he reduces taxes. He pays down the national debt by 1/3. He appoints office holders on the basis of merit, not partisan political affiliation. He released the political prisoners, which were still rotting in jail, believe it or not, from the Sedition Act of 1798. And he said, let's go forward. We are united in principles higher than party. So whichever party he would be affiliated with, he'd be urging strongly that we adhere to our higher national ideals.
Well, I brought that subject up because I was struck by one paragraph in the chapter Oneness from your book. And I'll read the edited version of it here and get your response to it because I think it fits into this part of the conversation. He writes, "The cement of this union is in the heartblood of every American. I do not believe there is on earth a government established on so immovable a basis. The greatest good we can do to our country is to heal its party divisions and make them one people." I wonder how that resonates in today's world.
People should pay more attention to that spirit of oneness. He said in a similar vein, you know, we are all members of the universal society of mankind. Can you imagine that feeling of identity with your fellow citizens in the country and the world? His friend Benjamin Rush called him, you know, the first world citizen because he always thought about it. And he was advocating the principles of freedom and self-government for not only for Americans, but for the entire world. And at one point he said, the ball of liberty is now so firmly in motion that it will roll around the world. Imagine that at a time when there's no liberty anywhere. He's also a man of patience. He said, you know, the ground of liberty needs to be gained by inches. So he really identified with the interest of his fellow man. And that spirit of, you know, the it's in the heartblood of cement of the union, as you read, being in the heartblood of every citizen. He was really convinced of that. And in the political battles that we referred to a few moments ago in the 1790s between the Federalist Party, you know, the party of Alexander Hamilton, George Washington, and John Adams, and his party, the Democratic Republican Party, the party of James Madison and James Monroe and Jefferson and so forth, he said the difference is this. One side, the Federalist side, fears most the ignorance of the people. That was the Hamilton view. Mm-hmm. Mr. Jefferson had heard Hamilton refer to the people as the great beast. He didn't really fully trust them. And his side, the Jefferson side, feared most the selfishness of rulers independent of the people. And, of course, Mr. Jefferson's view triumphed. That's why you have the egalitarian principles that he voiced in the Declaration of Independence triumphant today. And it's all based on an identification of the best in his fellow citizens and their feeling they were capable of self-government. That principle had never been proved on a mass scale up until the time of the American Revolution and Jefferson's consolidating the victory of the revolution.
And speaking of self-government, and it takes us to tyranny, I have a line here that I'm paraphrasing somewhat, in which he said, "You can say with certainty that no tyrant in Europe could be elected vestryman in any part of America."
That, again, is feeling of a confidence in the people. He said, you know, that the people have to be educated to a certain degree, but only they are the sure and safe guardians of their own liberties. And he felt that there was always a tendency in any society to allow power to be consolidated, whether it was political power, financial oligarchical power, that you might say we even have some of that today, or religious power, institutional religion, whatever the power was, it tended to be to want to centralize itself and ally with other institutional power centers at the expense of the rights of the people. And that's why, you know, so many people today refer back to Jefferson as the champion of the rights and the responsibilities of the individuals against the centralizing tendencies of the power centers and institutions in our society and our world.
Well, Eric, our time is just about up, but I want to thank you for the book because I found a line in it that I passed along to my son. He is a public defender here in St. Louis, and the line is, "He who knows nothing is nearer the truth than one whose mind is filled with falsehoods." I thought he might use that in front of a jury sometime.
that's very good. You know, he was a man of the heart, and even deeper than that, in the soul. And he said that the mind could easily be misled. He believed strongly in the importance of human reason, right? But he also believed that we have a deeper sense, a moral sense, an intuitive sense, a conscience. He called our conscience our faithful inner monitor. And he said that conscience is the only sure clue which will guide us free and clear of all doubts and inconsistencies. And it's a wonderful life philosophy. I'm glad you mentioned your son, because this Light and Liberty Project, obviously it's a nonprofit project, and we're trying to bring Thomas Jefferson's life, you know, light back into the American sky, and particularly at this time of year when people are graduating from high school or college. It's a great kind of gift book of America's ideals that really inspires people to think positively about their own prospects again and the prospects of our country.
That is Eric Peterson, editor of Thomas Jefferson Essays, titled Light and Liberty, Reflections on the Pursuit of Happiness. He'll be speaking Saturday at 2 p.m. at the Missouri History Museum's Lee Auditorium. And by the way, Peterson's earning no royalties for this book. The publisher Random House does not pay royalties on words already in the public domain. In a moment, an update on the City Arch River Project, uniting the Jefferson Expansion Memorial with downtown. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.